This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams and Glyn Lavender.
Hi, and welcome to episode 378 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com, and joining me from Melbourne once again from creativephotoworkshops.com.au, Mr. Glyn Lavender. How are you? Yes, the long wandering in the wilderness, Bruce Williams.
The man who came back with less camera gear than he left, Bruce Williams.
Yeah, that's the one.
The one who came home with wife and children much lighter when they got off the plane than when they got on the plane.
Yeah,
that right?
That's it. That's the one. Mongrels. Bloody.
How have you been, matey? Did you have an awesome trip?
It was absolutely awesome. It boggles the mind, you know, to get home with a couple of thousand images and to look at what we covered in 4.5 weeks and just go, how did we do that? How did we fit that much in? You know, but my feet attest to the fact that we did, because my feet are killing me. But, you know, it was good. I'm pretty sure we walked about half as far as we drove. I think we did about 50 kilometers shy of 5,000 Ks in the lease car that we had in Europe. And then we did a,
so you walked that far?
It feels like it, I tell you. And then our day in London, we hired a car and we probably drove 300 or 400 Ks there as well. So yeah, we said
in England, you managed to drive that far in one day.
We did.
Cause that's like, was that like 13, 14 hours constant going?
Pretty much, yes.
Yes, you don't get nowhere fast in England.
No, that's right. So, it was just an amazing trip. And I've been thinking about us recording this episode, and I thought, Glyn's going to ask
you away.
Me.
You crazy man.
Glyn's going to ask me, what did you learn?
Oh, was I? Okay, hang on a sec, Bruce?
Yeah.
What did you learn?
I knew you'd ask me that.
Yeah. It's like you're like your sidekick or something.
And I'm embarrassed to say I learned
none.
Two things.
Go on. Don't eat the pad thai.
Yeah, well, that's the third thing. It's embarrassing to admit that after 9 years with this camera, I've still managed to learn something new on this trip about that camera.
Like?
As everybody knows, I've only ever shot Minolta / Konica Minolta / Sony. So I don't know if this feature appears on DSLRs from other manufacturers or not, but...
Manual, yes. It's on Britain.
No, there's a feature in the A850 which, regardless of which mode you're shooting in, like aperture, shutter, manual, whatever, you can use this. It's like a preview button. So you compose your scene, and instead of pressing the shutter button, you press this preview button. And it essentially captures an image only into RAM. It doesn't write it to the memory card. And it then allows you to adjust the settings for the camera and give you a real-time feedback of what that shot would look like with the adjusted settings. And then if you, you know, make a few adjustments, you can then hold the camera up, recompose the shot, press the shutter button, and it'll then take the shot with those new settings. So, So from your reaction, I'm guessing this is not something that you've seen on a Canon before.
I mostly wasn't listening, but...
But no.
So let me for the part that I zoned back in.
Yeah,
there was something about if you took a photo, it didn't write it to the memory card.
Yeah,
you could look at it, change the settings.
Yep,
it would show you on the screen what it would look like. Well, why can't you just save that? Why bother taking it again?
I don't know.
Maybe, doesn't that make sense?
Maybe.
You've adjusted the settings. It now looks the way you want it to. Good. Save. Because what you were taking a photo of might not be there anymore.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah. But here's the thing. Here's the thing, right? Here's the thing. Yeah. This feature, I've assigned this feature to the custom button on the back of my camera.
Right.
And over the 9 years that I've been shooting with this camera, I've always had the image preview, you know, after you've taken an image, set to 2 seconds. So for 2 seconds, it'll show me what I just shot, and then it'll go back to the standard, you know, menu of, you know, the current settings for the camera. And this custom button, if you push it during the 2 seconds that the image preview is up after you've just taken an image, that custom button will then switch to a slightly smaller version of the image with the 3-channel histogram displayed. Okay. But if you're not in that, you know, 2 seconds of having just taken an image and you press this custom button, it then does this take a fake image and allow you to tweak the settings kind of thing. And so for 9 years, you know, I'll take a shot and I look at it on the back of the screen and I go, I just want to check the histogram to see, you know, how much I've pushed this to the right or lack thereof. And I'll go and push the custom button and I'll be right on the edge of that 2 second window. And so instead of getting the, you know, slightly smaller preview with the histogram, it ends up taking a photo of my feet and allowing me to adjust those settings. Which of course
can you adjust the settings of your foot and then see in the histogram.
Completely useless to me, right? And I must have been 2 weeks into this trip and it suddenly occurred to me, like, why have I not used this feature for what it was designed for, you know, which is when you've got really tricky lighting situations, this can be a great way of, you know, getting the image to look the way you imagine it in your mind before you go and write 4 or 5, you know, dummy attempts to your memory card because you're still trying to dial in the settings. So, like I said, kind of embarrassed to admit that I've been shooting with a camera for 9 years, never used this feature in the way it was designed until now. And a lot of the, you know, shooting inside of these massive cathedrals in Europe where, you know, you've got really bright highlights where daylight's coming through stained glass windows and then, you know, the whole of the interior of the cathedral is really dark. So you've got this massive high contrast thing which, you know, can throw the camera's sense of what you're trying to meter for, and so I started using it and went, wow, this is a great way of saving space on the memory card, because instead of taking 5 or 6 images to get what I want, I can just use this, you know, preview button, get a snapshot in memory, then tweak the settings to get the image looking the way I want it to look, then recompose the shot and take the shot, and you're only writing one image to the card and you've got what you actually intended to get.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was one thing.
Well, I don't understand why you couldn't write that version to the card. That doesn't make any sense.
Look, you know what? Maybe there is a way to do that, and I really should go back and read the manual again.
Possibly just the display might not be a full res. I don't know. Might not be a full res shot. Who knows? But tell me, if you've done a shot of water flowing at 1/1000th of a second, you can dial up what it would look like at 15 seconds or 20 seconds.
No, it's not quite that flexible. It'll allow you to adjust the settings to, I think it was about 2 or 3 stops either way. Okay. So you could see,
I'd love to know how it would blur the water in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what I found it really useful for was in a lot of those really challenging lighting situations, I was shooting in manual mode anyway. And so when you use this preview mode, it would then allow you to cursor either to the shutter speed or to the aperture and change either of those settings, and the preview image would, you know, change in real time to give you an idea of how an increased shutter speed or a decreased shutter speed would affect the ambient light within the scene. And so for the last couple of weeks, I was using that a lot and just going, why the hell has it taken me 9 years to work out what this feature was designed to do?
Well, I reckon it's awesome that it's taken you 9 years. I'm serious. I'm not being facetious for once.
Right, okay.
In the fact that it just goes to prove, and I've said this all along, we almost never ever get the most out of our cameras and utilize all the features and fully truly understand everything that these things can do for us.
True.
You know, and this is a perfect case in point. There's so many things on the camera that until maybe you're doing that sort of situation a lot, you're trying to find the best way of doing something,
yep.
Do these opportunities arise?
Yeah.
So it's awesome. It shows that your, yes, albeit 9-year-old camera, is still an amazing tool that can do things that not many cameras can do.
Yeah.
And you've still got ways to go to explore it to get the best out of it.
Yeah. Which,
so it's awesome.
Which is one of the things I've been saying all along about my reluctance to spend money on a new camera, because I've always said, you know, I don't feel like I've got everything out of this camera that I should. And it just goes to prove that I was right all along, that there were still things to learn.
Don't let your wife hear that.
No, exactly. Exactly.
You're a man trying to say that he was right. I mean, it's just, yeah.
But the other thing that I learned, and this was stupidly embarrassing,
As opposed to the last one,
was the 3 auto exposure metering modes, which are spot metering, center weighted metering, and wide area metering. So when you look through the viewfinder, you've got a little circle in the middle that maybe takes up, I don't know, 10-15% of the entire frame. So when you're on spot metering, the auto exposure algorithm only uses whatever falls inside that circle as the calculation for the shutter and aperture settings.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
When you go to center weighted, it uses maybe 40 to 50% of what's in the scene, but based on the center of the image. So everything
is usually like a 70, it's a 70-30 or 60-40 split.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And then your wide area auto exposure metering system essentially uses, you know, your 4 little L-shaped brackets out in the extremities of the frame. So it's using about 90% of the frame to calculate auto exposure. Now, I'm pretty sure that most of the last 9 years, I've had that set to wide area. But at some point in the last 12 months, I've obviously been shooting something where I wanted to use spot metering for some reason. And I'd obviously set it to spot metering and not noticed for the first 2.5 weeks of this trip. And then I went to take a shot and I was using this preview mode, right? And so I've framed the shot the way I wanted it, hit the preview button and gone, oh, wow, that's way too dark. So I've dialed in, you know, minus 1.5 stops of exposure compensation on the preview window.
Plus 1.5 if it was too dark.
It was too bright. And so I've dialed in minus 1.5. And then I've recomposed the shot to what I was fairly certain was exactly what I'd done before. And then I fired the frame and this thing's come out almost black. And I've gone, hang on, that could not have been metering the same area. And I went, well, what went wrong there? And so then I've started looking at the camera and gone, hang on, I'm on spot metering, which means I obviously metered for a fairly dark spot when I first took the preview. And when I've recomposed the shot, I've obviously had that center circle over a much brighter area of the composition. And so it's, you know, it's just completely shifted in the opposite direction and made everything pitch black. So that was the second embarrassing thing, was like, wow, I really need to pay more attention to what the auto exposure area is that's being used, you know, to calculate the shot, you know. So
exactly. I mean, you should do what I call the vesticles, testicles, wallet, and watch.
Right.
Which is, yeah, check all the 4 points, all the important stuff. You know, if you haven't used your camera for a little bit, or you're going out somewhere important, like first day of tour, it's just go through all the stuff. Check all the points. Okay. Where's the focusing point on? What kind of focusing system am I using? Is it continuous or a single shot focusing? Yep. Is it spot meter or evaluative or whatever it may be? Am I in bracketing mode? Have I got exposure compensation dialed in that I forgot? Or a shot? Yeah, you go through all this checklist of stuff.
Yep.
Because Murphy's Law is the first shot of the day is the best one of the day, and you're going to lose it because you stuff the whole thing up.
Yeah. Well,
oh, that could just be me.
No. It's interesting that you say that, because I was going to bookend this whole conversation with, despite how embarrassing those two things were, the key that I came home with was...
You're a tool?
And shoot more often.
Because yes.
These are the things that you only work out when you have the camera in your hand every day and you're out there shooting.
Well, unless you're an idiot.
Yeah. Or that. You
don't have to shoot more often, just know more about what you're doing.
I think it comes from it, though. It's habit. It is.
And knowing
the tool in your hands, you know, the more time you spend with it, the more likely you are to build the neural pathways that remind you of what all these features are and what their purposes are and why you'd use one over the other. And, you know,
it's also shooting stuff that you don't normally shoot. You shoot stuff that you don't normally shoot. You come across problems you don't normally have.
That's true.
And therefore you have to find solutions, which may mean you learn something more about your camera, because that solution was a new aspect of the camera you don't usually play with, because you don't shoot that way very often.
Definitely.
And you'd find that as you're traveling, you're shooting stuff that wasn't your normal purveyance of photography. Oh,
definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. So. You know, but it just showed me that, you know, over the last 12, 18 months where I, you know, haven't really picked the camera up a whole lot, just how many of those simple things can fall from your awareness.
Yeah,
just simply by virtue of not shooting, you know?
Yeah.
So that's my key takeaway, is just, you know, shoot more and be familiar with your gear. So
cool. Yeah. So what was your favorite location?
Favorite location? Do you watch Game of Thrones?
Sporadically. It's on the television. My wife is watching it. Oh. When there's a nude scene, I tend to look up.
Yeah. Right. Well.
So some in our audience will agree with that one.
We didn't even know this. We just finished watching Season 7, Episode 1, like 5 minutes ago. And there was a scene right at the end of that episode shot on the beach at Zamaya, which is in the north of Spain. And we had an itinerary of the places we were going to go. And one of the place we were going to go to in the north of Spain was San Sebastian. And we didn't book any of our accommodation prior to leaving Australia, other than a couple of key points like Paris and London. We were just booking everything 24 hours in advance.
Yeah.
Because we just wanted to see where the road would take us, you know?
Yeah.
And when we were in the north of Portugal and we were looking for somewhere to stay in San Sebastian, Kath was looking on the web at Airbnb and she's going, oh, it's a bit more expensive than I thought it'd be. And it looks really touristy. And I went, oh, well, blow that. What else have we got? So we started looking around on Google Maps and we found this town, Zamaya. And so Kath starts looking around. She goes, oh, there's an Airbnb there and it's available. And it's got really good reviews and it's good price. And I went, stuff it. Let's do that. Let's go there then. Yeah. So off we go ahead and we book this Airbnb. And it was quite a lengthy drive. That was actually our longest driving day from a little town called Faume in the north of Portugal across to Zamaya. It was about a 7-hour day. And along the way, Kath says, oh, apparently there's some really interesting rock formations at Zamaya, and it's quite an interesting location as far as geologists are concerned, because it's some of the longest rock strata formations anywhere in the world. And I went, oh, okay, that sounds interesting. So anyway, we get to this little town, and we had a couple of hours before we could meet our Airbnb host. And so we decided to go for a little bit of a wander around the town. And everywhere we went, we're seeing all these signs and names, and none of it looked Spanish.
Yeah. Right?
Now, neither of us speak Spanish fluently. We know a few words, but we don't speak the language.
Yeah.
But I recognize Spanish when it's written. You know, I think most people have got a rough idea of what Spanish looks like in the written form. This looked nothing like it. We're like, what is this language? We're in Spain. We know we're in Spain, but this is nothing like Spanish. And so Kath starts.
Was it Klingon?
Yeah, pretty much. So Kath types a couple of these words into Google.
Yeah.
And one of the references that comes back was the word Basque. Basque.
I know the Basque, yeah.
Well, I'd heard of the Basque separatists, but I didn't know...
Yeah, the Basque movement.
I didn't know who they were or what that was or what it meant or what it related to. So we went to Wikipedia and we've looked up Basque. And we find that the Basque country is an autonomous community, self-governed, doesn't answer to Spain, but it's within Spanish borders. And it's this, you know, couple of 100-kilometer stretch along the north of Spain, and it only extends about 50 or 100 k's inland. It's a population of, I think, only about 500,000 people, and the language has been spoken there since before the Romans arrived.
Right.
So this language only occupies this tiny little pocket of land, but has survived for thousands of years. And the thing that, you know, the nerdy side of me found extraordinarily interesting was that scholars cannot link the Basque language to any other language on the planet. It has no linguistic relatives whatsoever.
How unusual.
Yeah, absolutely. So the day and two nights that we spent in this place just absolutely blew my mind. It was pretty, it was a whole new culture that we weren't anticipating. It was nothing like Spanish. The language is completely different. The food was completely different. The rock formations on the beach were amazing. And on the day that we were there, I wandered down to the beach to look at the rock formations. Just a very brief aside. The reason I mentioned Game of Thrones is because anyone who's watched Season 7, Episode 1, the very final scene where Daenerys lands on the beach, that's the beach at Zemaya. So I've gone down to the beach to have a look at some of these rock formations, and I, you know, was taking heaps of photos there at one particular end of the beach, and then I've looked down the other end of the beach, and I could see what appeared to be some caves, and I thought, oh, might wander down there. So I wandered down to the opposite end of the beach, which is only half a kilometre.
Yeah.
And the waves were sort of crashing pretty much at the entrance to these caves. So I took my shoes and socks off and put them up on some high ground. And I wander around the corner and lo and behold, there's this other cave that was completely hidden from view from where I had been down the other end of the beach. And I've looked in, and this cave goes back about 20 metres.
Yeah.
And inside, there's this couple, young couple, you know, sort of late 20s, and they're doing this weird interpretive dance stuff, and he's got these wooden bells.
Is that what they call it over there? It's interpretive dance.
It's European, mate. It's very open.
Don't come in, Mum. I'm in terms of dancing in my bedroom.
and so he's got these sort of like tubes of wood that were like chimes, and they were connected by a rope, and he was sort of dancing with that, and she was doing these other weird moves, and he had like a Canon DSLR propped up on his camera bag, And they were talking while they were doing their move. So I figured, okay, he's only worried about the vision. He's not worried about the audio. And I said, oh, you're shooting video? And he goes, yeah, we are. And I went, okay, cool. And so I just grabbed a couple of shots, just natural light only. And anyway, he stops for a minute and he goes, hey, if I give you my card, can I get copies of anything you've shot? And I went, yeah, absolutely. I said, so what are you doing? He goes, oh, it's interpretive dance and yada, yada, yada. But they were a lovely couple, and both of them had great bodies. So I thought, oh, these guys seem pretty open to the idea. And as it happened, I had my flash in my camera bag. I had a flash wave trigger, so I popped the flash wave trigger on the flash and basically just dialed in some quick settings and was bouncing the flash off the roof of the cave. And, you know, I just started doing this impromptu shoot with them. and started directing them, and they were absolutely stoked. They were happy to take whatever direction I gave them as I was capturing some shots. And
yeah, get out of my cave and try to take a photo. That kind of direction.
In between shots, we'd see a massive wave coming, and we'd have to go and grab the camera bags and drag them another 5 meters into the cave so that they weren't getting washed away on the swell.
Love it.
Because the tide was actually coming in. And so we were working really quickly, and I did this whole range of images with them, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 images, just over a couple of minute period. And he gave me his business card, and I said, yeah, look, I'll absolutely send you what I've got. And it was really cool because it was so unplanned and, you know, and it was just an opportunity that presented itself. And I kind of wish I'd, you know, got to know him a bit better, but it was just like a real quick thing, and we had to, you know, get out of the cave before we got trapped in there because of the rising tide.
Of course. But, and had the photos come out?
Well, I was happy with them. I haven't processed all of them yet. I did very quick processes of them and uploaded them. I haven't uploaded them for him. I've sent him an email and said, look, you know, I've got the images. What did I? Maybe I sent him low-res versions on email, but I haven't heard back from him yet, so I don't know if he's seen them yet or if he's still traveling and not checking email or what, but it was good fun. It was good fun.
Well, good on you, mate. I'm delighted to hear you pushed yourself out of your comfort zone and
I totally did.
Jumped out and did that. No, it was awesome. That's absolutely fabulous.
That's
two non-facetious things this episode.
Yes.
We should quit whilst we're ahead.
We've skipped a lot of what we did, but I thought we'll talk about Paris because that was horrible. And Paris, yeah. Paris was kind of the start of everything going wrong. And I put it all down. I put it all down to this, you know, this one stupid decision of mine, and that was it was late at night. It was the what day was it? I think it was I don't even recall what day it was, but it was early last week, and it was the day before we were heading off to London. It was late in the evening. It was, you know, 11:30-ish at night, and we were at the Trocadero Gardens, or Jardins de Trocadero, as the French would say, which is just across the river from the Eiffel Tower, and I was wanting to shoot some nighttime shots of the Eiffel Tower. And from this particular location, they had a security fence because there was some work being done, and the security fence was like Rio mesh fencing.
Yeah.
Right. So rectangular, you know, wire holes, but just a little bit too small to get your lens through. So I tried taking a couple of shots through the fence, but realized that I was getting, you know, bits of this sort of Rio mesh in the edges of the frame. And so I've looked behind me. Back about 10, 15 metres, there were a row of little food vendors and trinket vendors and all the sort of rubbishy, touristy stuff you'd expect in a place like that.
Yeah.
And just to my side of the last one of those vendors, there were a couple of big concrete planter boxes that, you know, had shrubs growing in them. And they were maybe, you know, a metre and a half long and, you know, 50 centimetres high kind of thing. And right beside those, there was a concrete wall about 80 centimetres tall. And there were some people sitting on the wall. And I thought to myself, if I wander over there and I hop up onto that wall with my tripod fully extended, I might just be able to get enough height that I can clear the top of the security fence with my composition. So I can get the Eiffel Tower without this rubbishy bloody security fence in the way. So I said to Kath, I'm going over there to try something else. And she said, okay, no worries. And she was following along behind me. And I was walking along. I had my camera and my tripod in my right hand. I had my camera bag just slung over my left shoulder. And I've walked over to near where, you know, this planter box was close to this concrete wall. And I've put my camera bag down beside the planter box. I've put my tripod and camera up on the wall, and I've jumped up onto the wall. And Kath's come over, and she was standing right by my camera bag, but a little bit in front of it. So it was just behind her. And she was doing something on Facebook. And I've set up my tripod, and I've, you know, composed the shot into portrait mode and set it for like a 15-second exposure and did a preview and was happy with that and closed the, you know, the little guide over the rear part of the viewfinder so you don't let ambient light in while you're exposing a long shot, fired off the frame. And so while it's doing its 15-second exposure, I'm standing up on this wall and I've looked down at Kath and I said, "Oh, where'd you put my camera bag?" And she's looked up at me and she's looked down at the ground and she's gone, what? Haven't you got it up there? And I went, "No, it was there just a second ago." And seriously, we took our eyes off that bag for no more than 15 to 20 seconds.
Yeah.
And in that time, you know, some opportunistic mongrel, I reckon, has probably come behind the planter boxes, reached over the top, grabbed the bag, lifted it up over the top of the shrubs, and made for the hills.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show, you know, when you're in that kind of environment, you just have to be constantly vigil, you know. Yeah.
Well, you just can't put your stuff down effectively.
No.
And even when it's on you, you've got to be careful. But
yes.
Yeah, it's less chance if it's on your body than if it's down away from you at all. Yeah. Yeah.
So they ended up with my 70 to 300 kit lens, which I'm not, you know, not massively cut up over that because they're, you know, maybe
$27
$100 to replace, you know. What I am gutted about was my 20mm 2.8 Minolta Prime, my wide angle. And on Facebook, I referred to that as my second favorite lens, and I referred to my 135 2.8 as my favorite lens. But I actually think my 20mm was probably my favorite simply based on usage. I use that 20mm on so much stuff when I travel. Where my 135, I tend to use primarily for portraits, and I don't do a lot of portraits, you know. So, in all honesty, my 20mm probably was certainly my most used lens, and probably the biggest ticket item to replace by today's money out of the stuff that got stolen.
Which is good.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that one I bought, you know, I mean, it was a 30-year-old lens. I bought it secondhand off eBay for about $400, but you know, I would imagine that to buy a Sony equivalent of that today is probably $1,500.
Well, if you can get an A-mount version, of course, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'd...
So this is the thing. So an E-mount one's only about $400.
Right.
But that doesn't go on an A-mount camera.
No.
So the insurance company is going to have some struggles. Many years ago.
Yeah.
Even this is back in the days of film, just as autofocus cameras were starting to become successfully useful.
Yep.
I had all my Olympus gear stolen. Right. And one of my Olympus lenses was their 35-70 2.8. Now I bought all this kit when I started out photography in 81. I bought all this stuff secondhand, a camera, like four or five lenses, flash guns, and it's like $660 it cost me.
Right.
Which was a lot because it was like five weeks wages. Yeah, so it was a lot of money.
Yep.
But yeah, it was lay-by and over, you know, and I was working for the store, so I could get a good deal. But when that lens, all that gear got stolen, that lens alone to replace cost them, I think, $1,800 or something.
Wow.
Whereas the F4 version, the cheaper version, was only like about $300 lens.
Yeah, right.
So, of course, that $1,600 lens bought me, body-wise, a brand-new top-of-the-range Nikon autofocus body at the time.
Yeah, right.
So I became a Nikon user after I lost all my Olympus gear, and all the rest of the gear bought Nikon 7200 2.8, so all this great Nikon stuff for what was just this basic film stuff, but yeah, the cost to replace. And this happened lots of ways. There was this little Rolly 35 camera.
Yeah.
Little folding one. You could pick up secondhand for $200, you know?
Yeah, right.
But in the 1990s, Leica had a classic new version of the anniversary classic or something. It was $15,000.
Ow.
So if you had your $200 one stolen and you demanded enough with the insurance company that you wanted a like-for-like replacement, they had to replace it with this $15,000 camera because it's the only one.
Right.
And the way the insurance – this is how – for anyone who ever was again has anything stolen, this might apply to you. This is how the insurance game works in this country. Insurance companies get a list of stuff that's stolen.
Yep.
And they then go to the store. They go to several stores that they use to bid for the stuff.
Right.
And what the stores do, the stores, they bid down to the cheapest possible price. So they bid under cost.
Right.
And whoever bids under cost the most to the insurance company is the person they use.
Right.
And they say, okay, go to store X, and then you've got X amount of money to spend. And the X amount of money to spend is lower than what it would cost you to buy the gear.
Okay. Right.
But legally, they have to give you all that gear.
Yes.
Okay. But the reality is when you go into the store with, say, your $2,000 to spend, it's the salesman's job to tweak you onto something else.
Right.
Normal pricing, but actually make some margin.
Yeah, right.
So if you have some stuff stolen, yeah, know that's the game, and you can use that to your advantage because you can say to them, so, well, look, I know the game.
Yep.
I know that basically if I say I want this stuff, you guys are going to lose money. Well, maybe I don't want that stuff. Maybe I want this stuff over here, but the price you're going to give me is a damn sight better than what you thought you were going to give me 10 minutes ago when we started looking at. And you can screw them down to the bone. Because otherwise their option is to make a little bit of profit on this or make a loss on the stuff that you actually want.
Yeah, right.
And, of course, you know which way the war's going to go. So there's a little trick for young players.
Interesting. Yeah.
No, that's how it works in Australia. I've got no idea if it works in other countries. And albeit this is a long time ago since I figured out that system, it might not still be the current way of doing things, but I can't imagine how it would have changed.
No, can't imagine so. So I lost...
So was it insured, though?
Well, we had travel insurance, and I've got the email, you know, saying, oh, we're sorry to hear of, you know, your experience, right. And here's the link, click on here to make a claim. So I need to go through all that process now that we're home. Because I know they're going to want receipts, but the trouble is a lot of the stuff that I had, I bought off eBay.
So you're screwed.
Yeah. So I
do you have serial numbers, though?
No.
Yeah, so you're screwed.
Right.
They'll say, you've got no serial number, you've got no receipt, you've got no claim.
Yeah, right.
Did you get a police report?
Yes.
Okay, so it's maybe something.
When I said that, you know, the week of hell began with this bad decision, so basically what happened was once we realised, you know, that the camera bag had been stolen, Kath said, well, look, you know, if you want to make an insurance claim, we have to make a report at a police station within 24 hours.
Yeah.
And so we Googled where's the nearest police station. It was about 6 blocks away. So by this stage, it's 11:45. So we've walked the 6 blocks to find that the police station is shut. About 20 metres up the road, there's a restaurant that's just closing for the night. So I've wandered up there and I said, hey, guys, look, don't know if you can help me. This is what's just happened. We're looking for a police station so we can make a report. Guy shows me on Google Maps. He says, this is the nearest 24-hour police station and it's two different trains to get there. So we're like, oh, great, you know. So we hop on the first train, jump on the second train. We get to the police station, you know, probably 10 past midnight. And the police, naturally being French, spoke very limited English. But they were genuinely helpful. They were, you know, doing their best to understand what had happened. And so we sat there and lodged a report and I had to document everything that had been in the camera bag, which I, you know, did my level best to remember. Rakesh, I'm sorry to tell you, your Black Rapid strap was in the bag, mate. I owe you a new Black Rapid strap.
Did I mention I'm a Black Rapid ambassador?
Yes,
now?
You did.
I'll see if I can get you a replacement.
But Rakesh loaned me his because, you know, of the last episode.
If the insurance company won't come through, I'll see what I can do for you. How's that?
Thank you, mate. So
not for you, for Rakesh.
Yeah, for Rakesh, yeah. I gather that. So, you know, by the time we'd finished lodging the claim, it was 1:30, and Kath said, I think we'll just grab an Uber to get back to our Airbnb. And I said, yeah, fair enough. because we knew that we were going to have to be up at 6:30 to be out of the Airbnb by 7:30 in order for us to get to Gare du Nord, which is the international train station where the Eurostar leaves for London.
Yeah.
By 8:30 because it was a 10:30 train and you got to be there 2 hours in advance or some rubbish. I can't remember now. But so basically we had very little sleep. You know, we got 4 hours of sleep before we were up and at it again. And then on the train to London, Kath says to me, we're booked into a hotel out near Heathrow. I think when we get to St. Pancras Station, which is the terminus in London, we should jump on the tube, go out to Heathrow, check into the hotel, drop the bags, then jump back on the tube, come back into town, we'll do some sightseeing, and we can stay in town until we meet up with Max after the kids were going off to see The Lion King at the Lyceum.
Yeah.
And we were going to meet up with the school group after that performance, and Max was then going to leave the school group and come with us. So I said, yep, that sounds fine. So we headed out to Heathrow. It's an hour and a half because every train stops at every single station.
Yeah.
So we get out there and we check into the hotel. And, of course, I now no longer have a camera bag. And so Kath had a blue and grey backpack. So I said, well, look, I'll take the backpack and I can chuck my 135mm lens in there and we can chuck a water bottle in there. Have a Springsteen baseball cap, you know, because it was lovely sunny weather everywhere we went. And so off we go into town. And we walked, and we walked, and we walked, and we walked, and we walked about 13 kilometres for the afternoon, according to Google Fit. And anyway, so it was around about 10 o'clock, which was when the performance of Lion King was due to finish. And I said to Kath, I said, look, I really need to get off my feet. My feet are killing me. So she goes, yeah, all right, fair enough. Well, we'll head down to the area around St. Paul's Cathedral because of the hostel that the kids were staying at was near there. So we get down to this area and we found a little pub. Great, you know, just typical English pub. You go, yeah, beautiful. We'll just stop there for a drink and we'll rest our feet. And we go into this pub and they had booth seating, you know, and so... Yeah. So I've slid in on one side of the booth and put my back against the wall and laid my legs out along the bench seat. So I got the weight off my feet. And I put my camera on the table and I put the backpack on the floor under the table. And Kath's come back with the drinks and we're having the drinks. And then she gets a message from the school teacher who says, hey, we're back at the hostel now. And so she sends him a text back and goes, great, we'll be there in 10 minutes. So we hop up and we walk out and we go to the hostel and we meet up and get Max and we say goodbye and we jump on the tube and we're halfway out to Heathrow.
Yeah. And it
dawns on me that I don't have the backpack. And I'm just like, no, this isn't happening. And we get out to our hotel. I had to jump on Google Maps in order to work out what the pub was called because, yeah, you don't pay attention to the name of a pub that you walk into. And it's called the Centre Page. So I've rung them and I got this girl, Anita. And I said, look, about an hour and a half ago, my wife and I were in there. We were sitting in this booth. I think I've left a blue and grey backpack under the table. It's got a lens for my digital camera. It's got my cap and, you know, a few other bits and pieces. She goes, yep, we've got it. I said, okay, great. I said, look, we've got a really busy day tomorrow, which was the Thursday. I said, but I should be able to get there around about 9, 10 o'clock tomorrow night. Would that be okay? She goes, yeah, that's fine. We'll be here till 11:30. I said, okay, great. So the next day, Kath's organised for us to hire a car. We're going to drive out to Windsor, look at the castle, drive out to Bath, look at the Roman baths, drive down to Salisbury, check out the cathedral and maybe Stonehenge, and then back to London. So that's what we did for the day. And along the way, I stopped and picked up a new CF card because the only CF card I had was now the one that was in the camera, which was only an 8-gig card because all the other memory cards went in the camera bag. Thank God I was backing up my images every single night.
Yeah.
You know, to the Samsung tablet. So I at least had copies of everything. And here's the interesting part. I also had two
USB. There is an interesting part.
So I had a 64 gig and a 128 gig USB key, and they were in the camera bag. Yeah. And I was making duplicates of all of the images from the tablet to those USB keys. And when I was documenting it all at the police station, Kath says to me, "What were the USB keys doing in the camera bag? They should have been back at the Airbnb." And I said, "No, if the Airbnb had got broken into and they'd nicked the USB keys and the tablet, we'd have nothing." You know, it's all about distributed backups, right? So that's why the USB keys were in the camera bag. So I at least had, you know, every image I'd shot for the previous 3.5 weeks on the tablet. So we do this day of traveling around southern England. And as luck or bad luck would have it, we didn't get back to Heathrow until 9 o'clock. And so it was close on 9:30 by the time I got onto the tube, you know, because we had to drop the hire car back off. And Kath and Max said, "Oh, they're going back to the hotel," and I'd go into the city on my own because there's no point all three of us going.
Yeah, exactly.
So I get on the tube. Hour and a half into the city, you know, of course it's two trains to get to St. Paul's because you had to change halfway or at a point along the way. So I get out at St. Paul's Cathedral at 11 o'clock and I'm thinking, this is cutting it fine. So I'm power walking towards to where the pub is.
Yeah.
It's about half a block away from the pub and I saw a girl walking towards me going in the opposite direction. She was just lighting a cigarette and she'd just thrown a bag over her shoulder. And my intuition said to me, "That's Anita." And I didn't say anything. I just walked straight past it because I was just intent on getting to the pub.
Yeah.
And I get to the pub and the lights are off, the doors are locked, nobody there. And I seriously wanted to cry. I was so exhausted and exasperated, and you know, it's now, you know, 11:15 at night. I've just wasted an hour and a half of my life to come into the city. I've now got to waste another hour and a half of my life to get back out to Heathrow. So I'm not going to get back to the hotel until close to 1 o'clock, knowing I've got to be up at 5 o'clock because we've got an 8 o'clock flight in the morning out of Heathrow. And so I was seriously on the verge of tears. I hopped back on the train, went back out to, you know, the hotel, got to the hotel, and I've jumped on the web and I found a contact email address on the pub's website. And so I've sent an email and I said, "Look, this is what happened. I came into the city. The place was all locked up at 11:05. I'm flying out of here in a number of hours, but I've got some contacts in England. I might be able to organise somebody else to pick it up for me if that's okay." And I fall into bed. And 4 hours later, the alarm goes off. I get back up, check my email, and lo and behold, there's a message back from Anita. And she said, "Bruce, so sorry. We had a really quiet night. We closed early. I didn't have any way of contacting you." She said, "Look, don't stress." She said, "We will look after your gear for as long as it takes. Just let us know when you've organized someone to come and get it and it'll all be fine." So I went, "Okay, great. Thank you." As it turns out, the wonderful, the lovely Jenny Glexner, who is a photographer here on the central coast of New South Wales, who lives a stone's throw from me, is currently in England on holiday as well. And I reached out to her on Facebook and told her the story, and she's going to pick it up for me and bring it home in a week or two. So,
how awesome!
It's just been crazy, and so
it's been weakus horribilis.
Oh, the last week was just horrid. So we then fly out of London. We fly to Doha. We have 3 hour stopover in Doha. We then fly to Phuket. We get to Phuket, and I said to Max, who's now 16 and a half, and I'm thinking Thailand.
Well, since the story started.
Thailand, Thailand, not very rules and regulation heavy. I said, "You know what, mate? They'd probably let you pilot your own jet ski. Let's go grab a couple of jet skis." He goes, "Cool." So we head off down to the Patong Beach, which has got to be the cheapest, tackiest, nastiest, touristy place you've ever seen in your life. And a place to which I would never go back. So we go down to the beach and we negotiate with one of these jet ski vendors for a half hour on two jet skis. And I've used jet skis with my glasses before and never had an issue. But this was going in off the beach. And gone over the first wave, come nose first down into the second wave, copped a face full of water, and boom, there goes my glasses. Prescription lenses, multifocal, you know, so reading glasses at the bottom half of your lens and distance vision at the top half of your lens, straight off into the ocean, never to be seen again. I'm like, oh, man. So I've turned the jet ski around. I've headed back to the beach. The guy's come wading out into the water. He's going, what? Is there a problem? And I said, man, I just lost my glasses. And he's going, where? And I said, well, somewhere out here. And he's going, well, you go and ride the jet ski and I'll look for your glasses for you. So for half an hour, I'm just belting around in the ocean, pretty much completely blind. No idea. I can see vague colours and shapes, and that's about it. I'm thinking, as long as I don't hit anything, I'm all right. You
know? Oh, God.
So I come back to the beach at the end of the half hour, and he didn't find my glasses. I didn't think he would. And Kath says to me, where are your glasses? I went, yeah, don't get me started. And I said, I'm screwed. I can't see anything. You know, I'm just walking blind here. So anyway, we go wandering off around Patong Beach. We end up in a shopping centre, and there's a little kiosk in the shopping centre that sells all different types of glasses, like, you know, reading glasses, distance glasses, sunglasses. And they've got, like, script lenses at different strengths.
Yeah.
And she says to me, what strength is your script? And I said, I wouldn't have a clue. And she goes, well, try these. And I went,
I think I'm under blind Pete.
Yeah, exactly. I said, well, that's horrible. And she goes, okay, try this one. I said, well, that's awful, but it's not as bad as the first one. She goes, okay, so we want to go further in that direction. So she goes, try this one. I went, oh. So I've ended up with these glasses that are the same script in both lenses, which is not what my eyes need. I need a different script for each eye. But the script is perfect for my strongest eye.
So, should have bought two different glasses and just sort of hung them sort of angled.
Cut them in half and gaffer taped them together.
Exactly. There you go.
So for the princely sum of $8, I got a new pair of glasses.
That you can see out of one eye.
I can see out of one eye, yeah. So,
gold.
And then to finally cap off the week, on Tuesday of this week, which was our last day in Thailand, we had to check out of our hotel by midday, but we'd organised our taxi to pick us up from the resort at 5 o'clock to take us to the airport, which was an hour's drive. So our plan was, we'll leave our luggage at the resort, even though we're checked out. They'll look after
your luggage. Or any old place you choose to leave it, like you've been doing the rest of the trip.
Yeah, exactly. They'll look after it until 5 o'clock for us, and we can just go and spend the afternoon down at Patong Beach. So we go down to Patong Beach, and Kath and Max had found this place the night before, and they said, oh, we'll go here for dinner. And I went, or for lunch. And I went, okay, fine. So we go there for lunch. And Kath orders a prawn pad Thai. And she cherry picks all the prawns out of it and eats a few of the noodles. And of course, Max at 16 and a half is just a vacuum cleaner, you know. So he eats all of his lunch and half of mine. And Kath says to him, you should try pad Thai. It's not spicy. You'll probably like it. So he has a bit of a pick at the noodles and goes, oh, yeah, that's good. Scoffs the rest of it. So anyway, 5 o'clock comes. We get back to the resort. We jump in the cab. We're about three quarters of the way to the airport. Kath says, oh, I don't feel well. I think I'm going to be sick. And I was like, oh, really? And I thought, oh, maybe it's motion sickness. You know, she doesn't travel in the back seat that well. And we get to the airport and she says, you guys go and check in. I'm going to the bathroom. Anyway, she ended up throwing up twice before we got on the flight. We had an hour and a half flight from Phuket to Singapore. We get off at Singapore. We're meant to have an hour and a half before our flight, which was meant to be an A380. And as we're walking down the gangplank from our plane down into Changi Airport, there's a couple of Singapore Airlines guys standing there. And one guy's going, anyone for a connecting flight to Sydney, make yourselves known, blah, blah, blah. And we're like, oh, no, what's going on? And we go, yeah, that's us. What's the story? He said, your flight's been delayed till 4:30. Meant to leave at 1. But we're putting you all onto another flight that leaves in half an hour. So we've all got to do this mad dash across Changi Airport on foot.
Oh, it's a good thing it's a small airport.
Yeah, exactly. And so there was a guy who was blind who had a cane, and there were a couple of kids. No, it should have been.
Those glasses.
There were a couple of, I think there was a couple of kids, and they've all got to go on this bloody oversized golf cart thing that zooms off. And then the other guy says, okay, we've got to walk, we've got to make it snappy. And I'm thinking, man, not only is there Kath, there's another woman who also had food poisoning. They're struggling to walk at all, let alone to walk fast. Anyway, this guy's bloody, you know, power marching us across Terminal 2 at Changi for about 12 minutes before we got to the SkyTrain. And by that stage, I'd fairly got a bit of a temper up about it. And I said, mate, you should have at least checked before you let us off on this goose march across the airport that everyone was fit and healthy enough to do it. I said, you've got two women here suffering food poisoning, can barely walk at all. And he said, oh, they should have got on the cart. And I said, well, I thought the cart was coming back for the rest of us. And he goes, oh, no, there's only one cart, one driver. It's like, well, dude, seriously. So we catch the SkyTrain.
Information that would have been handy earlier.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So we get on the SkyTrain, which takes us over to Terminal 1. We've then got another 10 or 11-minute walk through Terminal 1 to get to our departure gate. And so he's still rushing us through the airport. And we then get to the departure gate, and they haven't even started boarding. It's like, oh, man, I was just livid by that stage. So we get on the plane. The three of us have got the very back row seats on the plane. And I once got stuck on a flight back from LA where I was in the back row but in the center of the plane where you're up against the back of the galley.
Yeah.
And the problem with those seats is they don't recline.
Yep.
But the people in front of you, they can recline.
Yes.
So we've come down to our seats, which were on the side aisle, not in the center. And I said to one of the stewards, I said, do these seats recline? And he goes, yes, they do. And I went, oh, thank God for that. So we hadn't even got off the ground. We were still taxiing along the runway. And Kath goes, get me a sick bag. I was like, oh, crap. So she pukes a couple more times over the next half hour. Then Max says to me, I'm not feeling real good, Dad. I was like, oh, what? So between the two of them, I reckon they filled about 10 sick bags between Singapore and Sydney. And I was in between them. Cats on the aisles. Cats in the aisles.
I would have moved that. I would have fixed that. That would have been something that would have changed very early.
And Max had the window seat. So it was just rough as guts. And naturally, I got no sleep whatsoever on that flight. We got into Sydney yesterday morning at about 10 o'clock and, slept pretty well last night, I can tell you.
Oh, my God.
So that whole last week of the trip was just horrid. And, you know, and I put the whole, you know, leaving the backpack under the table at the pub down to the sheer exhaustion of the previous 48 hours.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know,
You just do stuff you wouldn't even normally think about. You're just tired.
Exactly.
And that's how you get injured as well, because you just make a misstep or something. And fatigue on a trip is something you've got to be very careful of.
Definitely. So, So that that's kind of the highlights of the last 4 weeks.
And all the low lights too.
And some of the low lights,
Dear, oh dear.
What have you been up to?
Well, I think we've done enough talking for one night. I've got a couple of quick things before we wrap up. Next week I'm in Perth, 3 days.
Oh, you're doing your wheat belt shoot.
Doing my wheat belt shoot, but also on the Thursday night, the 27th of July, for any Western Australian listeners, I'm doing one of my Tamron travel talks at Camera and Electronic. Well, it's at a pub near Camera and Electronic, so in a function room.
Right. In which suburb?
It's in Perth itself, in downtown Perth itself. Right. So I think it's at the Northbridge Hotel. But if you're in Western Australia, you want to come along, it's on the Camera and Electronic website. I'll get in touch with them. They'll show you where the link is to book tickets.
Yep.
It's a free night. So I'm doing a talk there. Right. I've still got a couple of places for the weekend, so if anyone wants to join me for that, that's good. I've just announced a Bangladesh new type of tour. I'm doing a new style of photo tour.
Okay.
Called Mentor Explore.
Right.
So I'm taking only five people with me to Bangladesh in the second half of February next year.
Yep.
And the whole concept is to, yes, to tour and see the place, but to, I will mentor your photography for the entire 2 weeks.
Wow.
So hence why there's only five photographers being invited along.
Yep.
And yeah, we'll just go through everything. We'll learn all the stuff about learning how to use your camera properly, learning how to see light, how to use light, how to create light, all that sort of stuff. Think of it like a 2-week-long workshop.
Yep.
But better than that, because I won't pester you quite as much as a workshop. So there'll be stuff like, once you've done a shop, we can talk about it. You can show me. And we're a normal tour. It's a lot more free and relaxing than that.
Yeah.
It's a lot more just, we take you to places and you're a little bit more to yourself. This will be a lot more about me trying to guide your photography along a bit. So there's only three places left for that. I only announced that last week, but there's two places gone already. Nice. So for the measly sum of $5,500 Australian,
right?
Big difference. $54.95 Australian. It's 12 days, 11 nights.
Yeah, nice.
Five people only, so plus me. All accommodation, all ground transportation, inboard flights, internal flights.
Internal flights, yep.
Internal flights, yeah. All a local pro photographer guide. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a local guide, but a local pro photographer guide who's internationally renowned, judges photo competitions around the world. He's a member of the Bangladesh Photographic Society, one of their esteemed members of that or whatever.
Yep.
So we've got incredible local guiding knowledge from this guy's a really good photographer, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And we're going to explore some incredible and very little visited parts of Bangladesh.
Awesome.
And capture some remarkable photos. So if anyone wants to get in touch with that, drop me a line. Mm-hmm. And lastly, I've been talking to a couple of new sponsors of late, looking at some new gear. But I'll as they come to fruition, I'll mention those. But I did get to play this week, or was it last week now, with the new Tamron 18-400 and the new Tamron 24-70.
Wow.
And I'm going to tell you, that new 24-70 looks like it's going to be a game changer. It is just, the build quality is astounding.
Okay, but what's
better than anything Sigma or Canon or Nikon have ever built?
So how does it differ from my 24-70?
Your Tamron?
Yeah.
Build quality, especially.
Okay.
Massive upscale and build quality. Weatherproof, dustproof, all that sort of stuff as well.
Okay.
Much faster focusing, much better image stabilization, which doesn't really matter so much on your Sony, but it does matter on us Canon Nikon users.
Yep.
So there's the advantage. So our image stabilization can improve. Yours is what it is, you know. And your nine-year-old camera. Your camera's image stabilizer doesn't even take into account the rotation of the Earth, dude.
Right.
Yeah. You call. So it looks like a remarkable lens, I've got to say. And so I couldn't actually take any photos with it because it was a pre-release sample. So it's not actually a production model. They haven't got the latest firmware or anything in it. So, but from just actually using it, looking through it, not taking photos, but looking through it and using it as you would a lens, amazing piece of kit. So it's going to go gangbusters. So look out for those, which will be out in a few weeks' time, I'm sure. So
cool.
Anyway, that's it.
All right. Do we want to cover the thing that...
next episode.
Okay.
We've been going over it now. Let's let people. I mean, your story's put half the audience to sleep anyway.
Okay. Thanks, mate. good to chat with you.
You too, mate. It's good to have you back.
Yep. And I guess we'll talk to you in a fortnight.
Or 2 weeks, for those who don't know what a fortnight is.
Yes. Our American listeners would not know what a fortnight was. Okay, mate. Talk to you then.
Take care, dude.
See ya.
Bye, everyone.
ShutterZincPodcast.com.
AnotherAudioTier.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@ShutterZincPodcast.com.